Thanks very much, ladies and gentlemen. I appreciate everyone largely staying for this. The last time I got up to address an audience of this size was at the Melbourne Writers Festival, and the speaker just before me was Professor Robert Mann, and there was a bit of an exodus as soon as he finished before I got up, so it's heartening to see most people still staying. Thank you. I'd originally prepared for this to focus on state politics, but I'll look to, without going over time, also give my thoughts about what's happening in the federal scene, given the significance of that as well. And there's a fair bit of dovetailing when doing that. As tempted as I was to put up tables and graphs about the impact of one vote, one value on the next state election, I figure that unlike economic modelling, which most of you in this room presumably would be very interested in, I'm not sure that anyone other than myself would be that interested in the sort of modelling of what the likely outcomes are from one vote, one value. But I will talk about that a little bit in the course of in the course of the speech. I think that at a state level, starting at a state level, I think that there are five essential factors that are going to be at play in this coming year. And they are in no order of importance. The CCC, with the nine reports still to come down. The fact that we have a new federal government. We have a new opposition leader as well, and the team that he has around him. We are in an election year, essentially, or a year out from an election at max, and that's got to have a strong impact on the political overview, obviously. And finally, one vote, one value, not just in terms of how that will impact on the seat-by-seat analysis, but actually how that will impact on the approach by the political parties to the year, because obviously the nature of changing seats means pre-selections and internal party matters can become that much messier as a consequence. So those are the main things I want to look at before then maybe having a brief look at the national level. But comparing now to last year, it's interesting because this time last year, looking at the year we've just had, it would have been not much has changed at the state level in terms of the CCC's continuing presence. It was pretty significant this time last year, and clearly Alan Carpenter and anyone else in the Labor Party will tell you it's going to be pretty significant over the coming 6 months as these additional reports come down. So not too much has changed on that front, whilst we do have a different opposition leader. At the federal level, however, an enormous amount has changed. This time last year, even though Kevin Rudd was new to the position and was travelling well in the polls, it was very much a honeymoon period, and there was a lot of scepticism about whether or not he would be able to sustain that kind of run throughout the course of an entire year-long permanent campaign leading up to polling day. Now, of course, he did it well, and the profound impact of that is something that I'd like to end on, time permitting. But looking at the state scene just to start, the problem for the state Labor government, and I do notice, by the way, on the seating chart for the lunch, I'm sitting with a whole bunch of ministers and Premier's office people, so I'm hoping that after my discussion it doesn't turn into a scene from Underbelly as a result of delivering my frank and fearless advice and thoughts now. But what the CCC, the interesting thing about the CCC is that with these nine reports that are coming down, we don't know what the content of those are. Alan Carpenter and the government doesn't know what the content will be. We obviously have some idea that some of the public hearings will no doubt be reflected in at least some of those reports. But beyond that, there are surprises galore, presumably, for the public, for the business community, and certainly for the politicians and the government as well. So that is a real uncertain driver for the political outlook as far as when the election's going to be. Because I doubt very much, contrary to some of the discussion that's been flying around in recent weeks, I doubt very much that Alan Carpenter is that keen to call an election anytime soon when there is the real possibility that a CCC report will come out, or more than one, will come out in the middle of an election campaign, which could be damaging and is just the last thing that he would need. It would almost be akin to an interest rate rise happening in the middle of a federal election campaign, which is never helpful for an incumbent. So I suspect that immediately pushes the election date back, in my view. It may be at the end of this year, towards the very end of this year, but I still think it's more likely that they will run full term, as they tend to have pledged to have done, and therefore the election won't be until early next year. Either way, however, one thing that we do know is that it would be very unlikely for the election to be any time in the first half of this year, because that would take the upper house and the lower house out of sync. And the only way that Alan Carpenter could have an early election would be to then also have a separate upper house election, and that is highly unlikely. That hasn't happened for decades and decades. So at the very least, whatever happens, we know that the election will be in the second half of the year. And the likelihood, I guess, of it being a little bit earlier rather than a little bit later will be heightened if these 9 CCC reports do come out in the first half of the year, as most people expect that they might. But there's no guarantee on that, and as I said, none of us can know. In some ways, on that major issue of the CCC, the best person to be giving the political overview is probably the Commissioner of the CCC, if he was willing to let us know when these reports are coming out. On the issue of a change of the federal government, it'll be interesting to see what effect that does have at a state level. On the one hand, it creates wall-to-wall Labor governments, and that's a pretty nice message for the opposition to be able to butt up against and suggest, therefore, there's a need for a change. That's particularly interesting when you look at the results federally here in WA. The Labor Party only won 4 of 15 lower house seats. They only hold 4 of 12 Senate positions. The WA vote for the Liberal Party, whilst it fractionally went down at the last federal election, their quota of seats went up, and it's still well above the 50% mark. So WA is clearly, at least from a federal perspective, it has been a Liberal state. I'm not so sure, however, that that translates very easily into the state sphere, because the things that were driving the success for the federal Liberals, in my view, in this state were things like John Howard himself, incumbency and the economy. And all 3 of those are not in place anymore, either at a federal or obviously at a state level either. So whether that WA support for the Liberals is easily transferable if Buswell's team can gain some traction is difficult to know. So the change of government federally on that sense, it's hard to calculate what it will be. The other factor will be that presumably the Rudd budget that comes out this year is going to be a fairly tight budget. Other than the spending commitments that he's made and pledges that he's made during the election, which he clearly intends to honour, other than that, there's going to be some pretty strong tightening of the budget, is my understanding. And if that happens, that's not always popular. First-term governments can get away with it, more than governments that have been there for longer than that. But again, I would have thought that the Carpenter government would want to see how the federal Labor government's first budget is accepted before going to the polls, and that again would point to a later rather than an earlier election, in my view. In terms of the opposition, a change of leader. Paul Omidyar has moved aside. Obviously, his personal approval ratings were decidedly low. Troy Buswell, if he can kind of keep his spirit fingers intact, has a real chance, I would have thought, to build momentum with some pretty strong new talent coming into the lineup. The issue, however, is whether they can do it in this term as opposed to next term, because other than people coming in by-elections, and they have one with Christian Porter, the likes of Deirdre Wilmot and so on, I think that the pre-selection for Cottesloe is a guaranteed. I don't think there was more than one candidate. The likes of Deirdre Wilmot coming in are good for the party once they're in there, but it's very hard for a Liberal opposition to take advantage of the increased talent coming into the parliamentary party when they aren't there yet before the election itself. So they haven't got them in their shadow ministerial lineup. They will get them with the one person with Christian Porter, but they won't get them with some of the other examples of new people that are coming in. So it might be one election too soon as far as that goes from a Liberal perspective. But there are real question marks about whether Troy Buswell will get over not having had a honeymoon period. And that's a really difficult thing to know, because politically interested people have known what aspects of talent and limitations he's had before he became opposition leader. But your general public really only starts to sit up and take notice of individuals once they're in that leadership role. Most West Australians would have struggled to name Troy Buswell before he became leader, much less now. So a difficulty for him is that his honeymoon has been cut short by some of his antics that came out ahead of him taking over the leadership, and some happy snaps from years gone by that have appeared in the Sunday Times. So these are difficulties for the Liberal Party. And at the end of the day, the other problem, of course, is that at a state level, when you're in opposition, you've got such a smaller team. So presenting a viable alternative to a government is always difficult. So it'll be interesting to see how he travels on that front. Being in an election year, essentially, or a year out from an election, changes the game a little bit from the government's perspective. Permanent campaigning 12 months out from an election, in my view, tends to make governments far more concerned about popularity than they perhaps once were before that. That can have a few different effects. I think it can create for bad government sometimes in an attempt to be popular. And what I mean by that is I don't have a great deal of time for governments that that abrogate their responsibilities for taking tough decisions onto plebiscites. And that kind of thing I think is increasingly happening in an Australian context, and I don't hold either side of politics accountable for that. I think it's a general trend. And governments are less likely in the modern age to take the tough decisions, and being in an election year, they're even less likely to take whatever those tough decisions might be. So I guess what I'm saying is that we're in an election year. I would expect the budget to end up being a bit of a giveaway budget despite the economic conditions. I might be wrong on that, but I'm expecting to get your traditional election year budget where there will be cuts to taxation and so on, and our under-treasurer's budget surplus might be eroded, perhaps against his will. But that would be what I would be expecting on the political outlook. The other side of it as well will be that the government, there have been plenty of claims that this government hasn't been as accessible as a lot of people in the business community would like. Well, my point on that would be that if they're ever going to be accessible, if there's any truth in that, now is the time. An election year is you are likely to be far easier at getting the ear of a government minister or indeed the Premier than you perhaps would be 2 or 3 or 4 years out from an election. So it's an important year for the business community to get access to ministers and the like that are perhaps more willing to meet and be available, even though they've got more time pressures on their hands. But at the same time as that being the case, don't expect responses to come anytime soon if they're likely to be controversial, because obviously in an election year it's about popularity number one and good policy perhaps number two or three or further down the line. Lastly, on the sort of pronged of what's expected at a state level is one vote, one value. And I really think that this is crucial at this election and for this election year as well. Just looking at the numbers, the size of the lower house goes from 57 to 59. And with that, there are 6 seats being removed from the non-metropolitan area in the lower house, and there are 8 seats being added into the metropolitan zone. And what this means is it's not just a simple matter of 6 seats go and then 8 new ones pop up in the metropolitan area, but there is also, by and large, a pretty total reconfiguration of the existing seats as well. And before looking at what impact this will have politically at the election, it does have a profound impact on the parties in the lead-up to the election, because it means that even sitting MPs are not as safe in their pre-selection as they perhaps would have otherwise been if it had not been for one vote, one value. So we're going to have situations where I think on both sides of politics we might see the airing of dirty laundry a little bit more commonly portrayed through the media than is otherwise the case, because there will be, particularly it has to be said on the Liberal side, there will be people that are left without a chair when the music stops because of this reconfiguration. And that is going to impact pretty heavily on what we see in the day-to-day politicking over the course of the next, certainly the next few months, as pre-selections are particularly winding up and there beyond as well, as recriminations perhaps continue as well. So one vote, one value has a strong impact ahead of the election. At the election, there's no doubt that one vote, one value will clearly cause problems for the Liberal Party. I mean, on the numbers that Anthony Green crunched for the ABC, the reality is that there are the Liberal Party previously needed 6 seats, if in coalition, to be able to secure government. They now need between 12 and 14 seats, depending on 12 or 14 seats, I should say, depending on whether they try to govern in their own right at 14 or in a coalition with the National Party, based on the new one vote, one value numbers by using booth results to calculate that. So there is a real problem there for the Liberal Party in terms of them being that much further behind where they were. And this has an impact, I think, on Troy Buswell as well, because perception is often everything in politics. And even if he narrowed that 12 or 14 seat difference, but still was less than Colin Barnett's result from the 2005 election of 6 seats, well, then he's got problems anyway, because in a perception sense he will be seen to have gone backwards, and that could cause problems for the Liberal Party going forward from there. But one vote, one value strongly favours the Labor Party. that's, you know, not to say that there was any skullduggery involved in bringing in one vote, one value. It's obviously, in my perspective, good that we have one vote, one value. That is what happens in the rest of the country. But it's certainly something that will favour the Labor Party at this election. The one caveat that I would say on that is that urban seats, when you look at the numbers down through elections, urban seats, particularly in mortgage belt tracts, which is where the population is increasingly going through the northern corridor and so on, mortgage belt seats do tend to swing more wildly at elections. When people in mortgage belt seats change their mind, they tend to do it in greater numbers than what the previous configuration was before one vote, one value. So the caveat is that there is an opportunity there if a mood for change grows that leaves the opposition in a position where they could capitalise on that. And the sort of things that could feed into that are obviously a change in economy and greater uncertainty, which we've already started to see, and also whatever comes out of CCC reports as they come down as well. So there is an opportunity there for the opposition, but I think that it is the less likely of the two scenarios given the overwhelming benefit that one vote, one value provides for the incumbent at the moment. At a federal level, just to cap at the state level, so I think we're at a real fork in the road position, if I could use that term, not dissimilar to when Kevin Rudd took over at a federal level just over a year ago, which was that there was... Will momentum come behind the new leader as it did federally, or will it not, and will the new leader not get off to a good start and never recover from that, as perhaps appears to be the case at the moment at a state level here? And it could go either way, and it'll really come down to what this first 6 months of the year is like, and I think if Buswell hasn't managed to build momentum in the first 6 months, he's not going to do it in the second 6 months, and that could then dictate how early or otherwise the election ends up being called. At a federal level, there are a number of challenges that the Rudd government has before it. I think that the most significant challenge that it faces is the dysfunction in the Liberal Party federally in opposition, because as I think state governments both here and around Australia have shown, I think dysfunctional opposition can often make for poor government or poorer government. And it's not just the fault of the party in government, it's often the fault of a less than robust opposition keeping them to account and keeping them on the toes as they should. And that is a problem for Kevin Rudd. And he's probably the right person to avoid falling into that trap, because he is very managerialist in his style and very proceduralist as well. So he will look to keep those doors open between his departments and his political staffs and ministers, and obviously his prime ministerial office as well. But that is something that he has to be very mindful of. The other factor that I think he has to be very mindful of is inexperience. When we look back to the Howard government in 96 when it came to power, inexperience was a major problem. There were few people in cabinet with ministerial experience. John Howard and John Moore were the only two. In the Labor Party at the moment, there are only two, Simon Crean and John Faulkner. I think Kevin Rudd has somewhat learnt from the ministerial sackings and resignations that were required in that first term of the Howard government, partly because of inexperience, by putting John Faulkner into the Cabinet Secretary position to take significant advantage of that experience, by putting Simon Crean into trade to take advantage of that in a very important policy area for Australia going forward. But when you look at the likes of Julia Gillard with a super portfolio, and when you look at a team of inexperienced ministers who have already started in some senses by showing that they are still talking about crises in a way that perhaps government ministers shouldn't. We saw that with Stephen Smith on his trip to the US, where he was speaking there, where he was talking down the Australian economy, still in opposition mode, if you like. That inexperience can be a real problem for new governments, and that is something that Kevin Rudd will really have to manage. And finally, I would say that the third factor that the federal government will have to manage is the KPIs that they've set for themselves. Kevin Rudd has set himself some pretty difficult to achieve key performance indicators. He is intending to match up to all of his election promises. Some of those are going to stimulate the economy in a way that perhaps isn't in the nation's best interests, but he's wedged himself in that sense. He does not want to be a John Howard core, non-core promises first-term government, but by the same token, he runs the risk of being able to be held heavily to account for any worsening in the economic environment or any worsening in the uncertainty in the economic environment. So Rudd living up to those high expectations is going to be very tough. And we can see it in his numbers, and I'll conclude on this. We can see it in his numbers. Kevin Rudd came into the prime ministership with the highest ever approval rating for an opposition leader, and John Howard lost the prime ministership with the highest ever approval rating for a prime minister. So there were high expectations on Howard and a high regard for Howard, even though he lost quite badly, although not as badly as it looked on the night. But there are very, very high expectations as a consequence on the new Rudd government and what they're going to do. And they are conflicting expectations from the left, from mainstream Australia, and so on, and the business community as well, and the trade union movement, obviously. So there are difficult expectations for Rudd to manage. He has the popularity. He still has the honeymoon of being in a first term. But watch this space, because they're going to be hard for him to hold together. The big thing working in his favour in that sense, of course, is that at the moment it looks like the opposition is still trying to come to terms with the reality that Peter Costello didn't stay on, and that's going to be a difficult thing for them to do. That'll cause problems for Rudd, but I guess it might politically insulate him at the same time. Thank you.